This episode of Stage 9 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike, and today I'm joined by Sarah from the Talk Film Society and other places around the internet. How's it going, Sarah?
It's going very well, thank you.
Well, thanks for coming on the show. John, my usual co-host, he's gone. He was on Endor hanging out with some Ewoks, and now he's back home at his new house in the swamp in Dagobah, whatever, getting settled and dealing with movers and all that crap. So hopefully he'll be back next week. He's been gone for a few weeks. Hopefully we'll have him back next week. But in the meantime, this gives us an excuse to talk about some cool stuff like Dead Like Me.
Excellent.
So before we get into that, actually, I just need to say one little thing that I neglected to say on last week's show. Last week we were talking about an episode of Supergirl for The Girl Who Has Everything, which was written by the new Discovery writer, Ted Sullivan. It was co-written by Derek Simon. I forgot to mention that. I apologize to Mr. Simon, but credit where credit's due. Anyway, okay, moving on. Sarah, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
You've done some stuff, I know, on Talk Film Society, which is Marcello's website and everything, and you've done some other podcasting here and there. What are some of the things that you've done online in the world of film?
Oh, man. In the world of film, a little bit less. I was a contributor for Fangirl Radio for a number of years. I was a volunteer for a while for the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. So a lot of people online know me from the comic book world and, conventions and podcasts and all that kind of thing. So, I have been writing for Talk Film Society, and that's been a fun opportunity. And then the other thing that I'm mostly known for online would be my short documentary Inside a Blue Box, and that is a film about people who build TARDISes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so, and that's been showed at a few showings here in the Pacific Northwest. So, and it got, quite a bit of attention from the online Doctor Who community, and that's been a lot of fun, so.
Oh, that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. But you're also a big Star Trek fan, correct?
Yeah, I'm a huge Star Trek fan. I mean, it's the first television show that I remember, like, my family sitting down and watching every time it aired. And I watch it every day because, I don't know, I just really love it. And as someone who has a lot of anxiety, it's become like almost a the way I treat my anxiety, because it helps. It calms me down and reminds me about what's important. So
for sure. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who do the same thing, you know. I mean, we've got a thread on our little planning site with all the people on the network where it's like, what Star Trek have you watched this week? And usually the lists are very, very long.
Yeah.
So do you have like a favorite show or anything like that?
I am, and I'm kind of the unpopular, at least in my friend group, opinion here, but I mean, I'm an original series girl, you know, Kirk, Spock, Bones, Uhura, Sulu, that's my favorite crew. It's the series that I watch the most often. It's the one I have the most affection for. And then, of course, my second choice would have to be Next Gen. So,
okay, yeah, that's. I mean, I'm definitely a big fan of both of those as well. You know, I used to do the original series show here on the network, and yeah, I mean, it's pretty great. Of course, I mean, some of the best television you'll ever see, and then the next week it's like some of the worst television you'll ever see. But those highs are so high, like masterpiece level, you know.
It's so good, and really, honestly, the level of kind of progressiveness and that kind of feeling of egalitarianism, while it's tempting to say that the more contemporary series have done it better, I still don't think they have, if that makes sense.
Yeah, they're building on what the original series like established, but I think, you know, given the time period and everything, like the leap that made from the norm, I think is much greater than what the later series did.
Like I judge it by like how many toxic masculine moments do you have per episode, and while you're like you can't go an episode of Voyager or TNG without Riker or, you know, one of the white guys on Voyager saying something really inappropriate. You know, they're very, very few and far between on the original series. I can name like some episodes where there are some glaring faults, but really the day-to-day operation of the ship, like I would feel, you know, more confident that I wouldn't be sexually harassed with the original series.
It's an interesting take. I, you know, with Kirk being sort of like the lead in that series, you know, that's not something that I would necessarily consider, but it's interesting. Interesting.
I always like Kirk always at like you know, William Shatner always acts Kirk as though his sexuality is being put upon him, you know, as opposed to Riker, who kind of acts, you know, he acts as like seeking it out. I think that for me is the difference, where Kirk's like, oh, a beautiful woman has fallen in love with me. Oh, my life. You know,
yeah,
so it's those little tiny differences in tone that I think that the actors in the original series just kind of gave it more nuance than their 90s counterparts.
I can see that. Yeah, I'm wondering how much of that has to do with, you know, the change, you know, the aging of Roddenberry in a sense. You know, there's a lot of discussion about how, you know, the original series is Roddenberry as a young man and, you know, Next Generation is Roddenberry as an old man, you know, that kind of thing. I wonder how much of it has to do with that, but that's interesting for sure.
Yeah, it was, I mean, you know, the late 80s, early 90s was a different climate entirely. There were movements where women almost embraced machismo a lot more. It was a very confusing time for feminism.
So I have to ask, like, what do you think about the J.J. Abrams, you know, Kelvin timeline movies?
I love them. Right. I mean, I know there's a lot of people who very much dislike them. Was the Khan film my favorite? A few loopholes there they could have closed up. But specifically Star Trek Beyond, I adored it. It felt to me like an episode of the old series. You know, the crew goes to ground on a planet and gets completely, you know, stranded there. And, you know, it just felt like that. It felt like an episode of the old series. They made a nod to, you know, the episodicalness of their journeys at the beginning as like a cute little fan service joke. And I thought they did spectacular. The tributes to Leonard Nimoy, of course, had me in tears every time. And it was just fun. It was fun. They had the right amount of camp, balanced with the right amount of levity. So I love it. I watch it pretty often, like considering like of movies that I rewatch, I've rewatched this one at least 4 times. So
yeah. Yeah. No, I'm right there with you in terms of the new movies. I mean, I thought, the first one in particular was amazing. Like I've said numerous times, much to, the dismay of everyone who listens, but I think that that may be the single best Star Trek thing ever. I don't know.
Did it really well. And the thing was, he really was a student of the series and brought that to it, which is what I think some of the older films lack. You know, they're trying to break from the television experience and give you a more cinematic look. But Abrams was not afraid to bring the show into the film. And I think that's what works for them.
Yeah. And the sort of like flip side of that, which is something which I always bring up, but you know, as progressive as Star Trek has always been in terms of its content, like I always feel like aesthetically, it's always been like one step behind the times.
Very, yeah.
And this is really, in a lot of ways, I think, bringing Star Trek into the new, you know, millennium. And, you know, I think that we're kind of seeing that influence on Discovery in the trailer and stuff, you know, that's out. And a lot of people, I think, are saying like, "Oh, look, they're just bringing in that JJ aesthetic." And I don't see it as that. I see it as bringing in, you know, a 2017 aesthetic. I think that's what's going on. But
yeah, women of color in the lead roles. You know, like a very diverse, as far as like Star Trek species and races go, they've got a really diverse look to it, and I think that's exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So speaking of, you know, people who are responsible for bringing that look to the screen, there's a bit of news this week with a couple of new Discovery directors. Well, one at least. Jonathan Frakes, you know, the big, you know, everyone is so excited that Frakes is returning to the franchise as a director. It was kind of obvious that it was going to be happening from what everyone was saying. And if you go back a few episodes, you can listen to us talk to Larry Nemechek about Frakes' work as a director on Star Trek and elsewhere. But yeah, Sarah, what do you think about Frakes coming back as a director?
I am excited. As I tell people, and they always get mad at me for it, Riker has to be my least favorite character in the Star Trek universe, you know, because he's the character is just an awful person. But I love Jonathan Frakes as a human being. I adore him. And I can enjoy his portrayal of Riker because I know that's the part that was written for him and he's embracing that, you know. So I'm not saying that Riker's not enjoyable. He just has to be, like, one of my least favorite characters. But I'm very excited because he is someone who brings the stage into everything he does. You know, he's a very theatrical person and a theatrical director. And that wisdom is always to his benefit and to the benefit of everybody who watches what he does.
Yeah, and it's an interesting case where, you know, obviously as you know, since he's an actor himself, he's very good in terms of working with actors. But I also think, unlike a lot of, you know, the various cast members who have made the leap into directing, he's also an extremely visual director. You know, I mean, you look at any of his episodes, and they all have like this really unique and interesting flourish to them, and they feel cinematic, which is probably why they hired him to direct, you know, First Contact and Insurrection. Are you a fan of those movies?
Yeah. I mean, I hold no ire for any of the films, and those two were the ones that always played, you know, on any holiday weekend in the 90s. And so, yeah. So, like, I've watched those two pretty frequently growing up. So they do. They hold a special place in my heart. And they look really nice. They're very dramatic in the way they're filmed. And I think that that's just part of his style. He wants to get the shots that are going to leave that imprint, where when you think back on moments you've seen Star Trek, you're going to see those shots, you know, those big dynamic shots.
Yeah. And it is really interesting how they are bringing him in. I mean, it's just one of those things which makes total sense on so many levels. I mean, for one thing, like, this is his day job. You know, he is a television director, so it makes sense that they're going to get him to direct the new television show. But then also, you know, he's worked outside of Star Trek with the showrunners, Gretchen Berg and Aaron Harberts, way back on one of their very first TV shows, Roswell. He was like the lead director on that, and also appeared as himself in a couple of episodes, which was rather amusing. And then, you know, you look at the whole thing where one of the things which they seem to really be doing with Discovery is bringing in a lot of, like, legacy Star Trek people to help with the show, whether it's Brian Fuller creating, or, you know, Joe Manosky writing, or Nicholas Meyer writing, or whoever, you know, as well as, you know, some of the design team and all that stuff. They really seem to, you know, while this is definitely the next step in the franchise, and they're definitely, you know, moving forward in a lot of ways, they're not letting go of the past. You know, they realize that there's a lot of people who spent a lot of time working on this franchise who know what they're doing and are, you know, the best in their field. And Frakes is one of them. And it's kind of awesome to see that he's back making more Star Trek. And, you know, if you look on Twitter, you can see, like, the writers who are there on set, you know, watching, who, you know, grew up watching Next Generation, and now they're seeing, you know, Frakes direct their script, and it's kind of beautiful, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's like, those writers are fanning out so hard. You know, that's an exciting experience. You know, they have had that kind of experience with Doctor Who, where, like, Davies and Moffat were huge fans growing up, and suddenly they get to write for Doctor Who, and they're like, holy crap, this is amazing. So I think we're at the point with Star Trek now that's what we're experiencing, is people who grew up with it are now getting to participate. And I don't care what people think, like, you've got to have respect for the source material. You know, like, there's a lot of people who are tempted to say, like, oh, well, you know, like, new stuff, it doesn't matter what it was before. But especially with Star Trek, like, I think that having that healthy respect for where it came from is so important to understanding the entire universe.
Yeah, for sure. So, okay, so we got Jonathan Frakes, you know, as we've said, legacy director, but I'm 99% sure that there's another director who's working on this show, and that's Doug Aronofsky. I could be pronouncing that name wrong, but that's how I've been pronouncing it for the past 17 years, so that's how I'm going to continue to pronounce it. Sorry.
We apologize, Doug.
But he was, you know, he posted a little, well, he retweeted the LA Times and their story about, you know, Discovery's premiere date and everything. And it's like, oh, that's cool. But then, you know, someone, you know, tweeted him, oh, I can't, you know, wait for the show. And his response was, episode 6 is my favorite, haha. Now, maybe he's just read the script for episode 6 and maybe it's the most amazing thing ever. And, you know, certainly that's a possibility. But I'm thinking the more likely scenario is that he's directing episode 6. So
that's a pretty safe assumption.
I mean, listeners can take it as they will, but we're taking it as he's directing episode 6. And if we're wrong, sorry about that. But Doug Arniakoski is a television director primarily these days, who's worked on a lot of shows, including a lot of shows that, you know, the producers of Discovery have worked on, like Sleepy Hollow, Limitless, and then also a lot of CBS shows like Criminal Minds and Bull. So, you know, that's kind of his thing. It just, everything about that, you know, just like with Frakes, it just makes sense that he would be directing. I mean, he's someone who certainly, you know, fits the bill in pretty much every way. And you said that you watched Sleepy Hollow?
Yeah, yeah. I watched the first few seasons of it before I got angry and rage quit. And what I can say about Doug is I'm really excited to see him work in an environment that is not so heavily controlled. Because what I've noticed about his television work recently with like Flash and Arrow and Sleepy Hollow is they all belong to networks that are really chicken about really doing representation, really doing like, you know, the reason I rage quit Sleepy Hollow was because they cast a strong female black lead and then kept constantly, you know, undermining her presence in the show with, you know, like sexy white ladies. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and you know that there's a lot of decision making going on from corporate, so to speak, you know, the money money people. And it just got too frustrating for me to watch. So I am looking forward to seeing his work on Discovery because it's, well, you know, considering who got the ball rolling, it's going to defy that kind of strict editorial control that is keeping Doug's more recent work from being a really good statement of progress and diversity.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that, you know, for sure. I think that, you know, even though like CBS has done a lot of these shows or whatever, I mean, the fact that it is on the app now instead of on the network, I think is going to, you know, signal a lot of other things. And I think they probably also know going into it, you know, what Star Trek fans expect in that regard, and they're not going to shy away from it. I haven't seen much of his TV stuff, to be honest. I mean, I know that he was, I think, like one of the producing directors on Limitless and Bull, and I haven't really watched much of either of those. But he has done a couple of movies that I've seen, and I have been a big fan of his ever since the beginning. I mean, just for people, if anyone wants to put a face to the name, he got his start, I think, as Robert Rodriguez's assistant director. And if you watch the documentary Full Tilt Boogie about the making of From Dusk Till Dawn, he's almost like the lead in that movie because he's the guy who's yelling at everyone to do their jobs. So, you know, you can actually see him in action on Full Tilt Boogie. But then as sort of a spinoff of that stuff, he directed Highlander Endgame, which I know is everyone's favorite Highlander movie. It was the one where they merged the movie and the show and everything with Adrian Paul and Christopher Lambert. Are you a Highlander fan?
See, I watched the show religiously as a young girl. And the older movie I've seen but not the 2000 one. So it's something I'll have to check out. The director's doing some Star Trek work now.
You know, this was his first movie. Everyone hates this movie because everyone hates every sequel to the original Highlander. But I didn't hate it. When I first saw it, I loved it. I loved it so much that, you know, I sent an email to Doug, who had a very accessible online presence at that point in time. You know, he was interacting with a lot of Highlander fans who had a lot of questions, which is pretty cool, especially considering the fact that it sounds like things didn't really go too well during the course of the making of that movie. So I saved the email that I sent to him. I stuck it in my DVD, and I'm going to read just a little bit of it. I would like to say that I was like 12 when I wrote this, but I was 20, so it's really freaking embarrassing. But this is what I wrote. You know, it was a little portion. I said, "Hi, allow me to take a moment to wax your car. I'm not exactly the biggest Highlander fan in the world, but when I saw your movie, I was completely blown away. I go to see two or three movies a week, and of all of last year, Endgame was undoubtedly the most pleasant surprise. It even made my top 10 list." And then I go on to ask him which of, like, the 10 cuts of the movie that were on the DVD was his, you know, director's cut. And he responded. And I'm not going to read what he said because, you know, I don't want to violate his, you know, privacy or whatever. But he basically, you know, explained that he hasn't seen any of the versions of the movie which were on the DVD or I think were even in theaters because he left the project due to creative differences or whatever midway through editing. But on that DVD is like a work print cut which was pulled off of like an Avid where like the special effects aren't done or anything, and he's like, "That's at least something that I was working on, so watch that one." So there you go. Nice. Yeah, so I've been a fan of this dude for years and years and years, and you know, one of the other movies which he directed recently is a movie called Nurse 3D. I don't suppose you've seen Nurse 3D. No. Okay. Yes.
You know what? Like, I feel like I may have stumbled across that in passing on the internet or something in a film group or something.
Probably. Like, but, probably. Yeah. It's as trashy as it sounds. It is the trashiest movie you'll ever see in your life. It's about a nurse by day who by night seduces men who are cheating on their wives and then kills them in, you know, very elaborate and violent ways. And it's in 3D, right? Which, yeah. That's really what pushes it over the edge for me. It's, you know, the trashiest trash you'll ever see, and yet I kind of love every minute of it.
I could see myself enjoying that, because, you know, it's a trashy genre, but at the same time, it, you know, women are normally the focus of these.
Yeah.
And so it does provide that little, you know, escapism type, like, yeah, given what's coming to, you know, like
it's a bit cathartic. Yeah,
so much in media, it's kind of nice to take an hour and a half to just let them have it.
And one of the interesting things about this in relation to, you know, Star Trek is that that movie was co-written along with Ernie Akosky. It was co-written by David Lowery, who is the guy who wrote Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, as well as some movies which I absolutely love, like Lakeview Terrace, and what was the one with Idris Elba and Beyonce and Ali Larder?
Oh, gosh.
Possession? Is that what it was called?
Sounds right.
That's an amazing movie, too.
My heart is telling me that sounds right.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely check out all of those movies for people who haven't seen them. They're all well worth it. So Possessed, is that what it was called? Possessed? I don't know. Whatever, we'll figure it out. So yeah, exciting times for Discovery. The crew is coming together as it has been for the past, you know, couple of years, and we're nearly there. But in the meantime, let's maybe talk about some work that Brian Fuller did in the past and how that might indicate what we can expect from Discovery's future. And that's Dead Like Me. Okay, this is a show, it was Fuller's first show that he created. He wrote the pilot while he was working on the last season of Voyager. He left Star Trek after Voyager. He was not one of the people asked to do Enterprise, and I don't think he really wanted to either. And he decided to do
Enterprise. Stay away from that one.
You know, there's good moments and bad moments, but
I don't know. When you ruin Gorn, I kind of like, that's it for me. I'm like, nope, no coming back from that one.
To me, there's no such thing as a bad Gorn. All Gorn is good Gorn, you know.
But a computer animated one,
You know, it's anyway. As the CGI is as cheesy as the suit was, so I can almost forgive it on that level. It's kind of meta.
I'm just a sucker for a good monster suit.
Sure. Yeah.
But that could be the Whovian in me.
Yeah. Regardless, the show that Fuller did instead of Enterprise was Dead Like Me, he left after just a couple episodes, and yet it sounds like, you know, from what you're saying, his impact was felt throughout the run of the series. So Sarah, would you want to give sort of a synopsis of what, you know, Dead Like Me is about?
So Dead Like Me is about a young woman. She's maybe 19 or 20 when the show starts, and her name's George, and she lives in Seattle. It's all filmed in Seattle, so it's a really beautiful city to film in, and it's kind of fun for residents of the PNW because we're like, I've been there, you know. Yeah. I know what that is. But she is killed by a flying toilet seat from outer space that falls out of a space station, and instead of passing to, you know, whatever afterlife Brian Fuller imagines we all get, she becomes a Grim Reaper and finds out that Grim Reapers exist. They work for death, and what she has to do is she removes the souls of people who are going to die violent deaths. So she's in a specific group of Reapers who deal with violent, painful deaths. She takes their souls out before they die so that they don't feel the pain of it. And so, you know, she did not leave things very closed because she was young. She did not leave a very, like, closed relationship with, you know, her parents. Her and her mother were very estranged, her younger sister. So you have her essentially living. She's, you know, they consider themselves undead, but living in the same city that she grew up in. And, you know, they're like, oh, don't. And so there's conflict between, like, should you or should you not talk to your family? You should move on. And then, of course, there is her own guilt over what she views as essentially killing people, you know, and her trying to save the people who are destined to die, only to realize that, you know, their soul rots, essentially, if they are saved and don't, they cheat death, their soul rots, more or less. So it's a really interesting series. Of course, as with anything Brian Fuller has created, there's this, like, optimism in the face of complete fatalism. Right. You know, like, George has to accept throughout the series that she can't save people, mm-hmm. you know, whether it be her family or whether it be the people she takes the souls from. But at the same time, you see her learning to live the life that essentially was taken from her, more or less. So,
Yeah, that really does seem to be a theme running through all of Fuller's stuff, this idea of like almost obsession with death and yet dealing with it for the most part, you know, like Hannibal excluded, like in a fairly lighthearted, like comical way almost, you know?
I mean, Hannibal still has his signature tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, you know, it's more buried in his beautiful visual, like, artistry of death and the way he likes to kind of elevate it to an aesthetic. But you can still see it. You can still see the optimism in spite of everything, which is kind of how, I don't know, like, to me, that's always been so magical, just the way he works it in, because it's not your typical like everything's fine, I'm gonna have a positive attitude. It's, you know, finding beauty in the absolute worst scenarios.
Yeah it's really interesting, like, because even like with Discovery, like, you know, one of the things which people keep on bringing up in that trailer is Doug Jones's character and how he's like, I've been biologically programmed to sense the coming of death, and it's, you know, it's here or whatever. And people are always like making fun of that, like, what does that mean? You know, which obviously we'll find out in a few months. But like that, just the idea that there is a character on this show which is all about sensing the coming of death. I mean, that's like the most Fuller character ever, isn't it?
So Fuller. It's yeah, it's very much pink. I was rewatching some Voyager episodes that he did, and if you look at the list of all the, I think it was 22 episodes that he did, it's like they are the episodes of that show that really deal with kind of the heavier aspects of science fiction. My favorite's probably Course Oblivion.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is the most Fuller episode of Star Trek that has ever existed.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, for those who haven't seen it in a while, that's the one where the aliens from the Red Devil planet make themselves complete genetic copies down to the Voyager ship of the entire Voyager crew, and then they forget. They did. And so they are, the episode just starts out with them living their life as the crew of Voyager. Well, they realize in the course of the episode that they've been, since they've forgotten who they were and started living as the characters of Voyager, they started, you know, trying to get back to Earth.
Yeah.
Which is what Voyager's trying to do as well. Well, they traveled so far away from their home planet that they can no longer sustain their existence, because they were just this biological goo stuff that gained sentience in that earlier episode. And when Voyager had to encounter and, you know, had conflict with them before, and they created themselves. So they got sentience and decided, we're going to genetically copy the ship and these people. And so they're breaking back down into goo. And it's, you know, and it, eventually at the end of the episode, like, they're like, oh, well, maybe if we do this. And Janeway's like, we have to get to Earth. I promised my crew we'd get to Earth. And they're like, but if we go back to our home planet, we'll survive. And she's like, no, we can do this. And then you know, Chakotay dies. And she was like, I was wrong. And so then it's like, well, let's go back to our home planet. Well, now we don't have time. Like everything just goes to shit, and it's like everybody dies. They try and send out, they're like, well, we lived, we were. And it's true, like, it doesn't say exactly how long, but they had been living and exploring the galaxy as the crew of Voyager, so they have all these logs about all the missions they've gone on and stuff, and they try and send that out into space so somebody will remember them, and they don't get to do that. And so, you know, everybody dies.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no, you know, they don't get to pass on their knowledge. They don't get to do anything. It's just, they're gone out of existence. So kind of, you know, and that's that. I'm like, yeah, that's Brian Fuller.
Yep, for sure. Yeah, that is a crazy episode. I watched it again last year, sort of like going into it blind, like having forgotten about it, and it was pretty great. Yeah. So okay, so Dead Like Me, you're a really big fan, right? I've only seen, because I know that he left after like four episodes or something like that, and I specifically watched up until the point where he left, and then I left as well. So I haven't seen anything past his you know, very, very brief tenure on the show. But how do you think the show maintained what it was he established, you know, whether thematically or anything? And are there any ways where you think it might have changed since he left?
The show, and I think because it had such a specific audience, and because that audience was made up of people who really loved that initial direction, it stayed, I think it stayed very true to the original direction of the show. Because if it hadn't, the audience who was watching it, the times when it did, like they were not having it, you know? Like, so there was a lot of accountability for them with that show. And while there were murmurs of them wanting to go in a different direction with it, the fact was that that it had such a devoted audience that was incredibly vocal about being like, do not, you know, like, we've heard this stuff, do not do that. I think because of that accountability to that original vision, it stayed very true to it. And in true Brian Fuller fashion, you know, George loses everything. You know, by the end of the show, it's not like she doesn't gain back her family, the friends who are around her, keep going away. You know, she doesn't have a big revelation about her character and try and change the person she is. You know, she remains herself and really, you know, ultimately at the end of the show's run, she is still experiencing loss.
Yeah.
So in that way, it's very, to the end, it remained very Fuller-ish.
Yeah. So you've seen most or if not all of Fuller's other shows, like the ones where he did stay to the end, right?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I guess my first question is, where do you think Dead Like Me ranks among those, you know, as far as the quality is concerned, you know, regardless of whether or not it's true to Fuller's vision?
So it's really difficult to kind of rank it with the rest of the Fuller shows because it was such a beginning. So if you are in the Brian Fuller fan club for the kind of musical composition paired with the strange, surreal visuals and things like that, you may or may not recognize Dead Like Me as a Brian Fuller show. If you're a fan of his Star Trek work, it's very, you know, you're definitely going to recognize that thumbprint in there. But if you're someone who joined the train with Hannibal or American Gods, it's going to be a completely different ballgame. For me, Dead Like Me is going to always rank number one with me emotionally because it had such a huge impact in my life when I was younger. So it came out when I was in college and I did not know television could be like that.
Yeah.
So it really changed the way I saw the genre of television. I never thought there would be a female protagonist I could relate to. in television, you know, everything was Kelly Kapowski. And, you know, as much as I loved her, I couldn't relate to it, which is another reason why Star Trek was always like a big dog whistle to me, because it wasn't like all the, you know, teenage drama that I couldn't relate to. It was, it had, you know, female characters that weren't cheerleaders in it.
Right.
And so it holds an emotional number one for me, but I still, you know, as far as the evolution of Brian Fuller after Hannibal and now after American Gods, I cannot deny that his style is evolving into something just extraordinary. And artistically speaking, those are really his masterpieces.
Yeah. Okay. I can see that. So, I guess my as sort of like a follow-up to that, do you think that Dead Like Me, even though Fuller wasn't around, sort of like stands as a legitimate piece of the Fuller canon?
Absolutely. Yeah. That show would never have existed if Fuller, I mean, it's his brainchild. And, you know, we... Star Trek was Gene Roddenberry's brainchild. And, you know, we lost him quite a while ago at this point. And even though he's gone, people respect his legacy so much that there's no piece of Star Trek where you look at it and don't say, yeah, that's a piece of Gene Roddenberry's legacy. He has his influence in there. And I think that's very similar with Brian Fuller, with shows like Dead Like Me, because that was something he set the bounds, parameters, and he created the world for it. He created the rules for it narratively. And thankfully, the people who worked on it after he left had respect for what he'd created and therefore were careful to keep his legacy within it. So it's definitely a Brian Fuller show.
So like we were saying earlier, I think this is kind of a very similar scenario to what's going on with Discovery, where, you know, Fuller obviously created the show along with Alex Kurtzman, and then due to scheduling conflicts or whatever, depending on who you talk to, he left in order to make American Gods. And, you know, they didn't throw away everything that he had established, although based on what he was saying, you know, we could expect, and based on what we've seen so far, it definitely looks like a lot of it has changed, you know. Do you think that there's any reason to, for one thing, worry about Fuller's departure, but also do you think that what we're going to get is still going to be Fuller in the way that Dead Like Me is still Fuller?
I definitely think so. Is it sad that he left? Yes. I think that it was very exciting, especially with his very singular visual style. I think if anything goes, it'll be that kind of artistic film aestheticism that he has evolved in his most subsequent, series, because that is hard to sustain, because it is such a very unique perspective visually. Now, as far as his influence narratively, I think it would be really hard to purge Discovery of that, because that initial world building is so incredibly important and so incredibly powerful, and he tends to be very good at it. You know, setting those rules and the boundaries of the world that's going to happen. And I mean, his stuff is good. like, who wouldn't want to build off that? You know, that kind of, because it is very Star Trek-y, that kind of his thing, like I said earlier, like that optimism in the face of fatalism. So I think that that influence is definitely going to inspire the people who took up the torch after he left. And I think we can look forward to seeing that influence throughout the whole series.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. You know, I mean, in a lot of ways, you know, I mean, anytime you hear it, and it's been, it seems like it's been happening a lot in sort of like geeky movies like Han Solo and Ant-Man and whatever, anytime you hear about like sort of like an auteur who, you know, develops something and then leaves midway through and you know, someone else, you know, good or bad, takes over, you know, there's always that sort of just like thing where you're just like, I kind of wish I could see what, you know, in this case, Fuller could have done had he stuck with it, you know, till the end. You know, what would it be like to see, you know, Fuller in his purest form? But that being said, I don't think that there's any reason to think that it will be bad. You know, I mean, Fuller obviously gave them a good foundation to work with based on, I mean, I say obviously, I haven't seen it, based on what everyone is saying. And, you know, the team that's in place now, I think certainly has respect for them, seeing as how they've, you know, been close collaborators with Fuller for years and years and years. And, you know, the new people who they've brought on, I think are equally as good. And I think what we're going to see, while maybe not exactly what Fuller had intended, I think in a lot of ways will sort of embody his spirit, you know? So yeah, I'm excited.
He had a lot of, when you look back at his work on Star Trek, he had a lot of respect for the source material.
Yeah.
And so he didn't come into this. So what I see, like with Han Solo, from what people are saying, it sounds like the two directors didn't have enough respect for the source material. Yeah. And which is why the studio finally said, no, I'm sorry, we're not going to do, you know, Lego Batman does Han Solo. And they brought in Ron Howard, who is a tested and true professional who has respect for the source material, and they know they can count on that. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, they came in to stir things up and cause a riot in the universe, and that's not what the studio wanted.
Yeah.
Brian Fuller did not come into Star Trek to stir things up and cause a riot in Star Trek. He came in to honor the legacy of Gene Roddenberry and to create a series that he felt paid homage to the universe and would fit in with it. And I think that's the big difference in those kind of scenarios. His reverence for Star Trek and his really unique and winning vision. I mean, when has he made or had his hand in a TV series lately that hasn't been critically acclaimed? That's something to respect and to run with.
Yeah, I don't have anything but you know, the greatest amount of optimism for Discovery, and a big part of that is because of Fuller's involvement, even if he's gone now. So yeah. Well, any final thoughts on Dead Like Me?
Just that it is an incredibly devastating and heartwarming show. It definitely kind of opened my eyes as to what television could be when I first saw it, and definitely creates this beautiful, you know, narrative fiction about an alternative to kind of the, we get a lot in the United States, we get a lot of, you know, the same ghost stories, the same, you know, angels versus demons. We get the same, like, you know, hell rises up to, and it's a completely different look at a story about afterlife and death and everything. And it's at the same time a lot of fun. And it does leave you with this insane hopeful optimism despite of everything. So if you haven't seen it, definitely check it out. It's such a good series. And every time, you know, I've made a new friend since like 2003, I've demanded they sit down and watch Dead Like Me. So yeah, definitely see it.
Yeah, you know, I watched the first four episodes or whatever it was because of the Fuller thing, and then I left partially because I wanted to move on to Wonder Falls and partially because I was like, oh, it's not Fuller anymore, screw this show. But, you know, hearing you describe it and everything, I definitely need to go back and finish it up. So I'll be sure to do that. Well, it's been fun talking about Dead Like Me today, but that's not all we're talking about here on the network, so here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Literary Treks.
McCoy eventually gets command of the Enterprise, and one of the reasons for this is that he makes little comments to Kirk occasionally about how he has a cushy job. You know, he's got, oh, this nice, comfortable chair he can sit in, because McCoy at this point, he's got a lot of people getting sick on the Enterprise. There's colds, there's broken legs or whatever. I mean, there's just, for some reason, sick bay is busy.
The 602 Club.
There's a certain aspect to what's happening with superhero stories where they really sort of want the villains to be more complex, and they want you to sometimes sympathize with them and have their personas be, you know, deeper, richer, you know, perhaps not so pure evil.
The Ready Room.
Yeah, I think it's almost like a journal or a diary entry, a verbal diary reflection in the middle of the episode, yep, when he's reflecting on society. And it's the thing that I love about it, it's all very socially aware and well-written. It's really well done. But Spock's verbal description of everything going on struck me this time.
This would be like if in The Next Generation you hear Captain's Log, First Officer William Riker, recording for Captain Picard, who's currently on holiday.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and discover what you've been missing on Trek FM. You can find our shows wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts for your iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, etc. You can also find us on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, or just download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. If you want to contact us, we'd love to hear your thoughts. You can share them on the Babel Conference, which is our listener forum on Facebook. Just go to Facebook and type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and we'll come right up. You can also send us an email if you go to trek.fm/contact and select Stage 9. Or you can find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. So Sarah, where can people find you and your work online?
So you can follow me on Twitter. That's at I am Sarah Buck that is IAM. Everybody always thinks it's just an M, but it's probably because I can't speak. You can, of course, find me on Facebook, Sarah Buck. I'm basically everywhere online as I am Sarah Buck. So find it. If you want to see some of my artwork, my URL is sarahandcaleb.com, and our YouTube channel is Sarah and Caleb, so you can check my documentaries that I've made out on that YouTube page, and I believe the link is in my Twitter bio, so...
I'll definitely have to watch that TARDIS documentary. That sounds really cool.
It was a lot of fun to make. I really enjoyed making it, so I think it's a pretty great little film. So,
Cool. I'll definitely check it out. You can find me on thenerdparty.com doing a show called Great Shot Kid, and you can find me on talkfilmsociety.com doing a show called Soderbergh 2828, and you're there too.
My writing, if you want to read my writing, talkfilmsociety.com.
And you can also find me on commentarytrackstars.com, where I do a show called Commentary Track Stars. And you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. Before we go, we'd like to thank our associate producers, Chris Steftenagel and Jeff Sutter. Thank you very much for your support, guys. If you'd like to be like Chris and Jeff, head on over to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And you can become a patron of the network. There you'll find all of our perks, including early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, etc. So check it out, and if you can, we'd really appreciate your support. Just head over to patreon.com/trekfm. All right, well, that's it for today. Sarah, thank you very much for joining me. I really appreciate it. You're more than welcome back anytime.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was fun. And I'll be back next week, hopefully with John, to talk about something which I honestly have no idea what it will be at this point.